And I mentioned I was going to this topic with trepidation, and the phone line's already lighting up with people saying, no, the city manager or the mayor did confirm that in Springfield, Ohio, they were eating cats and dogs. Now, I've been on the air for the last hour, and, you know, sometimes things happen when I am on the air and chatting. I have now searched the internet and X and other things like that. I don't see anything like that. The last statement I still see from the city manager says, while we are experiencing challenges related to the rapid growth of our immigrant population, these challenges are primarily due to the pace of the growth rather than the rumors being reported. I invite the callers to cite the source if they see it somewhere that I'm not seeing. I want to make sure I'm as up to date as possible. But as of right now, I don't think there's still any truth or confirmation of the rumors. And maybe, again, we're getting lost in the weeds of what this story really should be about. The fact that a fairly small town, a mid-sized town in Ohio, had 12,000 to 15,000 or maybe 20,000, depending on who you ask, Haitian immigrants move there in recent years and start working. And there are legitimate complications that that comes with that are not racist. They are not abhorrent to talk about. They are legitimate things that happen when immigrant populations come to towns that need to be discussed and figured out. And that's how it's been since the beginning of this country. And I think that there are legitimate discussions to have. So I bring on Cindy Byes, and I apologize, Cindy, in advance that I only seem to bring you on when immigration is the hottest topic in the news. Thanks for joining me.
Happy to be here.
You are my stalwart here to just kind of break things down from a factual perspective and a law perspective from SIU Law School of Law. I don't know if I've ever talked about your entire background here on WGN, but your background, a lot of it does revolve around immigration law, right?
Yes, I do teach immigration law, and I've worked with asylum seekers throughout my career, so it's part of what I do, yes.
Okay, so you're a good person to chat about this with. The immigrants that are living in Springfield, Ohio, I know you cannot categorically say every single one of them, but it seems to be the vast majority of them are from Haiti, and they are here, at least according to the government, legally, right?
That is what I understand from the government reports that I've read online. Most of them have one of two types of status. One is called temporary protected status, and the other is humanitarian parole. It would mean that all of them would be here legally if they're in one of those two statuses. However, both are temporary statuses.
And temporary meaning for how long, or does that depend?
Yeah, it's typically 18 months to 2 years, but they also get renewed. So many people stay longer than that when the government renews their status.
Can you explain what those two are and how someone gets those statuses to be here?
Sure. So temporary protected status is given when a particular country is in some kind of turmoil. It might be because of a natural disaster like a terrible earthquake or, you know, civil unrest or something like that, where it is dangerous for people from that country to go home. So, for example, for Haitians who were here, you know, prior either to a natural disaster or to the political violence and civil unrest that's going on in their country, it might have been unsafe for them to return. And so the government, our government, granted them temporary protected status to stay for 18 months. And every 18 months that is renewed and the government, well, reviewed, I should say, and it may be renewed depending on whether the situation continues. So TPS is for folks who were already here when the government recognized some kind of extraordinary situation in Haiti. Humanitarian parole is a similar program in that it allows people to apply to come to the United States for up to 2 years at a time because of significant humanitarian concerns. And they would have to have a sponsor here in the United States who would assist them. They have to undergo vetting and, you know, for safety and security purposes, you know, pay their own transportation, that sort of thing. And then they would be granted a temporary permission to come to the United States for a couple of years. And again, it's humanitarian. So it would be, you know, for people who are in danger in one form or another. And in both cases, both folks with TPS and people with parole, they have the ability to work lawfully while they're in the United States.
Okay. This is different than asylum, right?
It is. Asylum is a more permanent measure where you have to prove you'd be persecuted because of your political opinion, your race, your nationality, something like that, if you were to return home. And if you're granted asylum, you're able to stay long term. So this is different because these two are temporary statuses.
Okay. The humanitarian one, you mentioned you apply for that while you're still in the country of origin, right?
Yes, that's right.
And TPS is when you're already here. Does that mean there was at some point potentially some Haitian immigrants that had entered the country illegally and retroactively were granted TPS?
That's possible. Mostly, though, there are people who came legally, like let's say they came on a tourist visit to visit family or something like that, or they were here attending school, but they were only supposed to be here temporarily. It may depend on the terms that the government set. The government may say you must be here lawfully in order to apply for the program. So it really depends on the terms of the program. And the TPS program for Haitians dates back to 2010. That was the first version of it, and then it's been renewed several times since then.
So renewed under President Obama and former President Trump.
It's been renewed several times, yes, under both Republican and Democratic administrations.
Okay, I don't need to put you on the spot. The situation in Haiti, why is that status granted?
So Haiti is in terrible shape economically, politically. There's high levels of gang violence. There is high levels of food insecurity. You may recall their president was assassinated in 2021. Then the prime minister took over, but really the gangs have been in charge of parts of the country, in particular the capital in Port-au-Prince. And so it's very, very dangerous. And a lot of people, you know, are out of work or, you know, don't have sufficient food to feed their family. So it's in a very difficult position. I believe that in April of 2024, the prime minister resigned, and so they have some kind of a transitional council that is in place, but they haven't had, you know, national elections for a democratic government in several years.
So the vast majority of people that are Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio, did not go through the asylum process, which we've discussed largely with Venezuelan immigrants into the United States, but instead are part of an umbrella policy issued to a lot of Haitian immigrants for humanitarian aid for reasons that often would not get them in for seeking asylum.
That is possibly true.
Okay.
You know, asylum is a case-by-case basis. So once they're here, they could potentially apply for asylum. And in reading online reports from, you know, some of the Haitian statements from folks that are in Springfield, it sounds like some have applied for asylum.
Okay.
But they would have to prove that they would be persecuted on account of one of five statutory grounds, as I said, you know, race, religion, membership in a particular social group, that sort of thing. And oftentimes that requires a more particularized individual determination as opposed to the fact that, you know, there's been a natural disaster or because Haiti, unfortunately, has also suffered several natural disasters in terms of earthquakes and hurricanes and that sort of thing. So that's not going to get you asylum.
Okay.
But if you perhaps were part of the opposition party of government and would be persecuted on that ground, that might get you asylum.
Okay. So some may have come here on humanitarian relief, now may apply through asylum, even though because the circumstances have changed while they've been here. I mean, there's a lot of complicating reasons, but I think the overall point I'm driving at, and again, we don't know 100% about every single person there, but this seems to be the vast majority of people are there legally, as of right now, considered by the government.
I would say that's probably true based on what I've read, yes.
Okay. Don't worry, I'm not making you take a step back. No one's going to accuse you of anything, Cindy. Like, we're not going to come after you if it turns out one person isn't. So, okay, working in the United States then, I think that some people get confused about that. The reason being, I imagine that if the government says, okay, you're here legally, it pays better for everyone to work while they're doing so, to live the life they can live, and also then to potentially not be as much of a burden on the government, right?
Absolutely, yes. If they're working, then they're able to potentially, you know, pay their rent, buy their groceries, all those sorts of things, and they're not relying on government assistance. And they're paying taxes into our, you know, tax system. So it's better for everyone if they're working and they can support themselves and their families.
So taxes are taken out just like the rest of us and they file taxes at the end of the year like the rest of us?
Yes.
Okay. And I shouldn't say like the rest of us, assuming who I know is listening or not. So I apologize if this was too broad. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, basically, yes, they pay taxes at, you know, as a U.S. citizen would pay taxes on their income. Yes.
Okay. This is what makes this whole situation actually happen. The fact that they are able to work. Springfield, Ohio was a boom town in the 50s and the 60s when manufacturing was hot in the Rust Belt. It, like many Rust Belt towns, saw a decline. In the last few years, they've really picked up their business activity by saying, look at how centrally we're located between Dayton and Columbus. We're a great place for manufacturing. As a result, businesses have moved to the area. This happens to time out perfectly with when Haitian immigrants are arriving in the United States. And then, Cindy, maybe you could just broadly explain that this is kind of what happens sometimes with immigrant groups, where a few people kind of start the pipeline to a particular town because they hear about opportunities. And then naturally, people who know people who are in similar circumstances literally follow the pipeline to that town. That's not unusual, is it?
It is not unusual. It's very common. And you're absolutely right that many Haitians chose to go to Springfield because Springfield was actually advertising itself as a place that needed workers. And, you know, they had been in economic decline and they wanted to see population growth. They wanted to have people come and fill those jobs. So, as you said, you know, a group of Haitians went, had a good experience. And so they then, you know, shared that information with friends and family and more Haitians came. And so it just built from there.
Taking, let's say the number is 12 to 15,000 or 20,000, the town population, anywhere between 60 or 70,000. That is a giant part of the population, isn't it?
It is a huge percentage of a population for a town the size of Springfield, yes.
And Haitians, I was embarrassed to admit that I had to look up what their native language was. And then when I heard it was Creole French, I remembered that fact from years ago. When you have a bunch of people where English is not their first language moving to the town, not just the workers, but their families and children, that complicates things.
Yes, it absolutely does. Of course, you need people to translate or interpret for them until they can acquire English language skills. You need English language classes for them. The schools then often will be incorporating any school-age children into their English language learning classes. So that means, you know, more teachers in the schools needed for that and can present some different challenges for the schools. So, yeah, there are definitely challenges when you have that kind of an influx of an immigrant community in a short amount of time. I've also read that there have been some issues where, you know, housing costs went up because there was a higher demand for housing. On the other hand, I've read in Springfield that some of the folks are really thrilled that the Haitians came and are fixing up housing that had been pretty decrepit, you know, that they're, you know, renting it and fixing it up. And so it's actually improving the housing. So, you know, there's issues on both sides.
Yeah. For sure, and legitimate ones. And sometimes it takes a second to realize why it would be. Okay, obviously more people are in the town. There's only so many doctors. It's not like there's a direct relationship to the number of people that come to a town and the number of doctors that come. So there's less doctors. And not only that, a visit that may take 30 minutes for you and me might take an hour for someone who doesn't speak the language. It's just a clog.
Yes. So it definitely means that you need different resources. So in working with immigrant communities myself, I've seen that many of the medical services have, you know, translation services available where they can call on the phone or on the computer and make sure that they have the right language access that they need. But that does mean that there's extra time involved in that visit to the doctor. And so it can slow things down. So there are challenges as folks kind of acclimate, learn the language, you know, learn their way around, all those sorts of things.
I know that the federal government distributes funding to states to help with these sorts of things. And I only know that because you and I texted before the show and you told me that. My question I have for you is the federal and state government nimble enough to recognize, oh my goodness, 20,000 people in a town of that only has 60,000, let us divert a percentage more than we normally do to this area to provide direct sources? Or is the system of distributing money from the federal government to the states a little bit more set in its ways and not able to pivot as much? Do you understand what I'm asking?
I think so. And I think it's a complicated answer, that it probably depends a lot on the state and what kinds of processes the state already had set up before they got a large influx of immigrants. Relations between the states and the local city councils and communities around the state. So it probably varies significantly by state. I'm most familiar with Illinois, where when we saw large numbers of migrants being bused into Chicago, you know, the federal government provided a fair amount of funding for that was funneled through the state and then ultimately to the city of Chicago. But that sometimes meant that other communities around the state didn't get as much funding, even though some of those migrants might have ended up in other parts of Illinois. So, you know, it depends on what state you're in, what processes they have set up for, you know, distributing that money.
630 just texted, is this an interview or an interrogation? Cindy, I apologize if it's coming off like I'm shining a light in your face in a dark room.
No, you're perfectly fine.
I appreciate the text, though, because sometimes I can be very direct. Cindy, would you mind hanging on a little longer? Is that okay?
Yes, I can stay a little longer.
Thank you. Okay. Any more questions you have or comments about my interview skills, I will take them all. 312-981-7200. Seriously, though, if you have any questions about this to try and wrap our heads around what is happening in Springfield, Ohio, and also maybe as importantly, what's not, text them in now. We'll take a break. We have the news, then more Let's Get Legal after this. Let's Get Legal. We're powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Some great texts and calls coming in on thoughts about our discussion about what's happening in Springfield, Ohio. We spent the first 15, 20 minutes of our conversation breaking down kind of who is really there, why they're there, are they legally allowed to be there, and then some of the ramifications of what happens when you put 20,000 people in a town that aren't from there originally. One caller thought that we were spending too much time on the nitty-gritty details. That's what this show does. We want to find out the who, what, where, when, how, why, and not only focus on the human emotion of it. That's what the show is all about. I 100% welcome discussion and debate over things as long as they're based in reality. In fact, that's what we do here on this station and on this show. The caller did have a good point of the emotion that comes with a bunch of people coming to your town. They don't speak your language. There's some fear of the unknown, maybe some legitimate concerns too. And I do not mean to negate those fears that people may have in a neighborhood. I've been chatting about this with the professor from the Southern Illinois University, Cindy Bye. And yeah, maybe I glossed over too much how there are some concerns that people have. And that is kind of a story as old as time, Cindy, right? As new migrants move into communities, the kind of tug and pull that naturally comes along with that, right?
Yeah, that's very common. I have to say my own experiences in working with immigrant communities is that most of them are incredibly grateful to be here. You know, they're here, the folks with humanitarian parole or with temporary protected status, because it's a very insecure situation in their home country. And so the ability to find a place of safety is really important. And so while I understand some trepidation by the people in the town, I also would encourage people to be open to meeting some new folks and learning their stories.
And this is a very simplistic thing to say, but I have heard interviews with some people that absolutely love that the Haitians have opened up new restaurants to provide a culinary scene. That is just one aspect of it, I get. But I guess that's just one avenue in which a culture that is different than your own and different than you're used to in your hometown, which I know can be unsettling, but can provide a vibrant tapestry to the community.
It certainly can. And of course, there are going to be miscommunications and misunderstandings. That's part of what happens when two cultures come together and they're learning about each other. And so that's normal, too.
And if anyone's saying this is too kumbaya, I totally hear you. That is a legitimate concern. And there are honestly more things that happen, of course, that perhaps it seems like we're glossing over. But I just want to get to the facts here with the professor. Someone had a very good question. Former President Trump, who, of course, is running for president again, says he will. Generally, he talks about mass deportations. Specifically, he has talked about deporting these Haitian immigrants. You outlined the legal reasons or the legal status that they have according to the current United States government. does a president, any president, have the authority to issue mass deportations to a community like this that is currently under legal status?
Yeah, so if they do have legal status, the president would not be able to take that action until their status expires. You know, as I said, the TPS typically lasts 18 months at a time. Humanitarian parole typically lasts 2 years at a time. And then they have to be reviewed and the government makes a decision whether to renew them. So it is very possible that the former president were reelected, his administration could review it and determine that they don't want to continue one or both of those programs, at which point those folks would have to return home and could be deported if they didn't do so voluntarily, unless they found some other status that would allow them to stay lawfully. The government, though, would have to go through that review process. There's a lot of discretion of the president to take that kind of action. But there also have been instances where if the government doesn't explain why it's terminating a program, you know, the courts have said you have to at least explain, give reasons for it, although ultimately, usually the executive branch has the power to do that.
That's interesting. So they say it can't be as simple as the date was coming up. We didn't want to do this anymore. It's not renewed. Many courts have argued in the past, no, this isn't just an automatic yay or nay thing. You need to show us why.
Yes, because the law provides for some of these programs. And so to just terminate it and, would be arbitrary and capricious without giving some kind of reason.
It's very interesting that that does seem to give the executive branch a lot of leeway with immigration. Those you and I had talked about in the past, a lot of it requires congressional authority. We have a really difficult immigration system to understand, don't we?
We do. Very complicated, not working very well.
Yeah. And there have been many efforts to overhaul the whole thing, and not to get too much into the political weeds, but it just has never crossed the finish line, despite what seems to be a groundswell of support from the citizenry and often a groundswell of support from legislators themselves.
There are many aspects of our immigration system that need serious attention and reform. And you're right, there's a lot of desire to have reform. Of course, not everyone agrees what that reform would look like. And you know, when you get down into the details, you know, as they say, the rubber hits the road, right? And it's much harder to reach agreement.
I want to leave you just with this one question. And I really appreciate your extra time here discussing this specific situation. Anytime we talk about immigration, I just want to dispel of a myth that's out there. And this is totally understandable why people sometimes think this, and they're every right to think this. When often we talk about immigration, a lot of people say, well, yes, I know I am a child or a grandchild or a great-grandchild of immigrants, but my great-grandparents or my grandparents, they came here legally. Why can't people come here legally? Which totally makes sense in and of itself, right? That's how we explain to ourselves, like, well, I know we're a country of immigrants, but most people came here legally. For the vast majority of people who have our parents or our kids or grandkids or great-grandkids of immigrants, is this the same system today that our great-grandparents had when they came here near the turn of the last century?
No, approximately, you know, if your grandparents came, say, 100, 125 years ago, we had almost no federal restrictions on immigration at that time. We were welcoming people. We were trying to grow our country, settle territory, all that sort of thing. And so we generally welcomed folks. Around 1920, our immigration laws changed and started becoming more restrictive. And of course, there have been some major reforms. You know, there were some big reforms in 1965, big reforms in the mid-1990s. But that was really the last time that we had a major reform, was in the mid-1990s. So it's been a while, and it is a very, very different system today than it would have been 100, 150 years ago. And we do have many, many more restrictions on the number of people that can come and the categories in which they can come, you know, if they have a family member here or if they have an employer who is sponsoring them. But for the most part, just because someone wants to come to the United States does not mean that they are able to come. They have to fit into one of those categories.
And that's hard to do. I mean, like, extremely hard to do.
Well, it's just there's so much more demand than there are visas available. And so that makes it very, very difficult. It's not necessarily that they don't fit, particularly in the employment categories, but there just, you know, aren't that many visas allocated to that.
Yeah, people can have whatever opinion they want about who should be allowed in the country or not. That you are entitled to that, and there are legitimate arguments to be made on all fronts of that. But I just like to sometimes debunk the, well, my great-grandparents came here legally, why can't everyone do it the same? Which is, you know, an opinion you can have, of course. Just recognize that things are drastically different than when our grandparents, great-grandparents, and so on came here, too. Doesn't negate your opinion, doesn't make it wrong. I just want to, like, make sure we're all talking on the same playing field while we have these discussions. Okay, and that's kind of what you do for us, Cindy, with these hot-button issues. Thanks for navigating that with me. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me today. Look forward to continuing the conversation.
I always wonder if you hear a little bling on your phone at Saturday morning, if sometimes you wish you had ignored it instead, Cindy. But as always, I appreciate your time. Take care, okay?
You too. Thank you.
Professor Cindy Bies of Southern Illinois University Law.